analytical control. So how is it possible to derive such a result? So the idea here is the following. The master constraint operator is a function of, let's say, holonomies along edges, along loops, and then of powers of the volume operator, where R is a rational number. And V itself, acting at a point, was something like this expression here, 1 over I times 1 over 48, sum over triples of edges meeting at the vertex. Then there was some sine factor. And then there were these vector fields Rj, E, K. So let me call this guy here QV. So what do I mean by the absolute value of an operator? By this I mean QV, same thing as the square root of QV dagger QV. Now this is a positive operator, so you can so the square root is well defined by the spectral theorem. In fact, QV is already self-adjoint, as you can show. So you just have to take the square root of the square. So the reason for writing it like this is that QV, the matrix elements of QV, are known in closed form. And in fact, I told you that the Hilbert space can be conveniently split into Hilbert spaces of this form, where these are the linear combinations, or the closure of the finite linear combinations of spin network functions over graphs gamma. And H gamma has also a convenient decomposition in this form, H gamma J, summing over J, where these are the spin configurations on the edges. And these are all spin network functions consistent with the spin configuration J. And this Hilbert space is a finite dimensional Hilbert space. I really mean finite dimension, not finitely many degrees of freedom. Therefore, and this Hilbert space is left invariant by this operator QV. So when you want to, for example, analyze this operator, you can restrict yourself. Sorry, this is nonsense. It leaves the space invariant. So when you analyze this operator, you can restrict yourself to one of these finite dimensional subspaces and becomes just a big but finite dimensional matrix, and you can analyze it, try to compute the spectrum, and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, the matrix is quite complicated, and you cannot compute the spectrum in analytical form. You can numerically analyze it, and then you would like to compute this operator, the volume operator itself, by the spectral theorem. But as I said, you cannot do it in closed form. So what can you do in order to compute the semi-classical limit of M, or the matrix elements of the operator M in semi-classical or coherent states? Well, the thing is that what you can do is the following. So suppose psi is a coherent state. And let FR of Q V squared be just one of these functions that are appearing in this in the master constraint. So it's Q V squared to some rational power, and in applications it turns out that R is always smaller than one quarter. That's not important, but it just, well, this is the thing that is of interest to us. So now what I do is I take out the expectation value of Q V squared, which I can compute. This is known in an enclosed form. So if this is F tilde, then FR F tilde of Q R of V squared is psi Q V squared psi times F R of Q V squared, where Q F R to the power R, where F R of Q V squared is just, well, psi so it's QV squared to the power R divided by the expectation value. To the power R. And of course I can also write this as QV squared divided by psi QV squared psi to the power R. So now what one does is the following. So let me just rewrite this as follows. So let me call this x, this argument here. Fr of x is something like x to the power r. And I want to write this as 1 plus y to the power r. And we'll see why why this helps in a second. So you can bound this function fr of x by polynomials from left and then from the right. This is smaller than, in fact, than 1 plus r times y for all y bigger than minus 1. And so fr of x is also bigger than 1 plus ry minus r times 1 minus r halves y squared. So you can bound fr of x by polynomials. Now, polynomials of this operator can be computed again in closed form. So one can show then that if you take the expectation value of psi with respect to psi of fr of x, you can bound this from above by one plus r times the expectation value of y. What is y? Y is 1 minus this, or this is 1. This minus 1 is y. So qv squared divided by psi qv squared psi. So you see what this is already, this will be proportional to h bar, this expectation value, because what you see here, this is basically, this is basically the fluctuation of this operator. And you can also bound it from below by the same expression minus this one. So you can also talk about the error that you're making. And you can be more sophisticated. I mean, there's no reason to stop at the linear or the quadratic order. You can use the usual Taylor expansion of this function here in order to bound FR more and more precisely between two polynomials, and you can decrease the error. So you can develop what we call semi-classical perturbation theory and compute rather precisely the expectation value of, for example, the master constraint. These computations are straightforward. I mean, this is not more difficult than Feynman graph calculations.
Thomas, are the first two formulae consistent
on the left blackboard? Maybe I did a mistake. That's possible. F tilde is the one without the, so this defines FR. And here, yeah, you're right, this should be, no, this is correct. This is correct.
But still, the first two are not consistent.
The first two are not consistent.
I mean that the same left-hand side is.
No, this multiplies this.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. So this is the idea. I mean, you have this kind of fluctuation operator here. You expand it. You bound this operator that you are interested in terms of higher and higher fluctuations. Each power is proportional to an additional h bar power. That's why you can get semi-classical perturbation theory. And as I said, I mean, this is straightforward. I mean, it's nothing really very complicated. It's a lot of work, but it's like in very complicated Feynman graph diagrams. Okay. This is one thing I wanted to say. The next thing I wanted to say is the following. This operator, I said, is well defined. So that's somehow amazing, right? Because I mean, if you take the master constraint is something like has something to do with the Hamiltonian of an interacting field theory. So in an interacting field theory, there is usually ultraviolet divergences. So can one understand heuristically what's going on here? So let us compare actually the situation in with our situation with the situation in lattice-Young-Mills theory. So let's suppose we take a graph, a cubic graph, because people in lattice gauge theory they use usually cubic graphs like this in two dimensions, and of course in three dimensions. So this is a cubic graph, and this has been done a long time ago by Susskind or Kogart and Susskind. I think their paper was from 74 or something like this. So they of course, they're in Minkowski space, and they have a lattice spacing epsilon. And what they do, they discretize the continuum Young-Mills Hamiltonian, which is something like d3x, then 1 over 2 times g squared. This is the Young-Mills coupling constant, trace ea eb plus ba bb, and you have a delta ab because we are in Minkowski space. So this is the spatial part of the Minkowski metric. This is the magnetic part of the magnetic field of the Young-Mills theory. So if you want, you can express it in terms of curvatures in the following way, epsilon abc fbc. And let's suppose we are just doing SU2 Young-Mills theory, like for the electroweak interaction. Then this comes with a SU2 V algebra index. Okay. So what they do, they discretize this in the most naive form, and this was also propagated into works by Wilson later on, but he was doing it in the Lagrangian form. They did it in the Hamiltonian form. And what they define then is the following Hamiltonian. H epsilon is given by 1 over 2 g squared. Then comes sum over all points on the lattice, all vertices. And then there is a trace. E, let's say, SV, A, I will explain this in a moment, SVB, plus something like A of alpha VA, A of minus A of alpha VA times A of alpha VB minus A of alpha VB squared. That's it. So now what they did is something like this. On top of the lattice, you have also a dual lattice. So like in spin forms, we talk about dual lattice. I will explain this in a sec. I need this drawing here. So dual just means that for each edge, there's a face, a unique face, which intersects this edge. So these red lines are in two dimensions. Faces are also one dimensional. In three dimensions, of course, two dimensional. So this is the face in the A direction, so there's a sum over the directions here. This is a face in A direction. Let's say here we have a vertex. This is the A direction. Then this would be the face that intersects this this edge. And here we talk about the loop, which is transversal to the A direction. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right. So there's a minus one here missing also. Which, right, I wanted to come to that point now. So now let's see, very good point. So now let's see what's happening here. These faces are, of course, of size epsilon squared. And also the loops are enclosing an area of size epsilon squared. So if you take the continuum limit of this expression, then you end up with, in the leading order, an epsilon would be epsilon to the fourth. But you need only epsilon to the third in order to get D3x, right? So if you think of this as a Riemann sum approximation to this continuum integral here, then what you have to do, you have to divide by 1 over epsilon. So now let's compare this with our situation. Our situation, if you compute the Master constraint on the cubic lattice, you would get something like this. Sum over vertices. Now I hope I do get this right now. Trace. Then we have sil tilde of V squared, wait a moment. And C tilde of V was something like um A of alpha AV, and then there was a commutator A EV to the minus one, and then there was 1/2 of the power of the volume operator and the trace. And I think there was also another A of EV, like this. So, and the point is now that when you expand this out, and in particular, if you define VV as, so this would be now the restriction to this cubic lattice of this operator, it would be just correspond to the square root of epsilon ABC EJ EK EL SVA EK SBV EL SCV, something like this. Now this, when you look at this, this is this whole expression is proportional to the power of epsilon to the 6, and you take the square root of this. And if you also consider that this goes like epsilon squared, then you see that I don't need to divide by 1 over epsilon. So that's the basic point. So if I just give you this operator and I tell you this is a cubic lattice, this is just telling me something about the topology of the lattice. It doesn't tell me how fine it is. It doesn't tell me how, it doesn't have an intrinsic length scale or something like this. So in other words, this operator can be seen as a continuum operator. That's why you don't have to take epsilon to 0. There's no epsilon here. This is because of background independence. Epsilon can't be there, otherwise you have done a mistake, or you have not taken this principle of background independence seriously. So this operator is UV finite. Okay, now the next point I want to make is we have now this operator. What we want to do with it is we want to solve the equation m equal to 0, m psi is equal to 0. And of course, we know that in general, there will be no solutions of these equations in the Hilbert space that we are looking at. And I told you that the one proposal to solve such an equation precisely is by this rigging map construction. And I told you also that in general there's only you need to have a lot of additional input like this Haar measure. You have to equip the whole thing with a Lie group structure and so on and so forth. In this case, that we have only one positive operator, you can actually make this mathematically precise. There's this following statement in operator theory. Suppose M is self-adjoint, in our case is also positive, and H gamma is separable. So it has a countable base, and this is the case for our H gammas. Then H gamma can be written as a direct integral. So in other words, there's a unitary map which sends H gamma to a direct integral. I will tell you in a second what this means, which goes over the spectrum of the operator, spectrum. And then there's a measure on the spectrum. And there are Hilbert spaces, gamma, which are labeled by points in the spectrum. And these Hilbert spaces have an induced scalar product. So how, and this is both this measure and this Hilbert space are computable directly from the Hilbert space H gamma and from the operator M. Now, how do I now compute the inner product? So as the map, this unitary map, let's call it W. W maps a vector psi in H gamma into a bunch of vectors labeled by points in the spectrum. And you compute the inner product, so psi prime in H gamma. Now, this is the same as, because W is unitary, as W psi prime in this, let's call it H plus gamma. And how do you compute it? It's just given by d mu of lambda sigma of m psi tilde lambda psi tilde prime of lambda H gamma lambda. So careful, these Hilbert spaces may still be infinite dimensional. And in general, they are. So, but in principle, all of you have seen this already. This is nothing else than the Fourier transform. Just for now, for a general self-adjoint operator, not for the momentum operator of usual quantum mechanics. So this is, you can think of this as a generalization of the Fourier transform. And the point of this is, of course, that if you compute W, the image under the unitary map under of psi, m times psi, this is just lambda, the lambda component. This is just lambda psi tilde of lambda. In other words, the operator m acts on these Hilbert spaces labeled by lambda, just by multiplication by lambda. So this is the generalization of, so you can think of this Hilbert spaces labeled by lambda as the generalized eigenspaces of the operator M. No.
Question.
Yeah.
Sorry, maybe I'm lost, but what are we doing this if in general is the Hamiltonian is not a constraint?
No, I just wanted to illustrate the following point, that the Master constraint or the Hamiltonian constraint is something like a Hamiltonian, right?
Yeah.
So in Young-Mills theory, if you want to work in a representation like we are doing, then you have this problem that when you compute the continuum limit of the theory, you have a divergence here. So you have to renormalize, regularize something like this. Here, this is not necessary. In fact, people have not managed to work this with this. This is an open problem. If you solve this problem, you get $1 million. You get this is one of the Millennium Prizes that are offered by the Clay Mathematics Institute. Now this is all very nice, but unfortunately very complicated. For complicated operators like this, like our M, this is very complicated to do, because what you need to know in order to do this precisely, like here, need to know what people call the projection valued measure of M. I don't want to explain what this is. For those who know what it is, you know, they will know what I'm talking about. So this is just something that is usually very complicated to get. But of course, there's a heuristic. Unfortunately, there's a heuristic way to get this, and this will now also open the window and make the connection between the canonical theory and the spin form formalism. So the heuristic answer is the following. So let me and this goes with this rigging map procedure. So eta of psi was given to us by some integral, and in this case, the unitary operator associated with M, psi. And we want the translation invariant measure. Well, in this case, the unitary group that we have here, U of t, is isomorphic to the translation group. So we just integrate with respect to this measure. And then heuristically, what you get is here is delta of M C psi, right? And this is the basic idea behind this rigging map, because formally M delta of M psi is equal to zero. So now let's compute this scalar product. We said that the physical inner product can be computed in the following way. It's given by eta of this eta of psi prime applied to psi. So we get integral over dt by 2 pi times psi e to the itm psi prime. So here I have brought this exponential to the other side, but because I'm integrating over the whole real line, it doesn't matter. So now I plug in this formula here. Dt by 2 pi psi. Psi and psi prime are anyway normalizable with respect to the kinematical inner product.
Right. So suppose that psi equals psi prime, and both of them are normalizable, and they are solutions.
This is why this is heuristic. This is why this is heuristic. You will see this in a second. Just wait.
Something heuristic is a possible solution, which we
Can I still go on for 1 minute? Because you will come back to this problem in a second. So I said that M acts as multiplication operator. So when you map this function here with W, what you get is e to the I t lambda times psi tilde prime of lambda, and you get here in the inner product lambda. So now what I do is I can of course take this factor out of the scalar product because it's diagonal, and then I interchange orders of integration, and what I get is of course the delta function. Now this is formally given by some constant times psi tilde of naught psi tilde of naught h lambda naught. And this constant, as you correctly pointed out, is in general ill-defined. It may be zero, it may be infinity. So in order to account for this, one does the following. You take a reference vector. Omega, such that this is not vanishing, and then you consider instead eta of psi prime divided by eta of omega prime omega. And now this formally, this ill-defined constant drops out. So up to this factor here, you could say that the rigging map sends psi to the Fourier component, psi tilde of zero. And this integral, which is maybe much, much easier to compute than the projection valued measures of M, is now giving you a handle to analyze this question. So now let me make a brief remark on the connection between canonical and path integral formalism. You see, I don't want to make a distinction between loop quantum gravity and spin forms. For me, this is the same thing. There's a canonical formulation, there's a path integral formulation, and we should be able to connect these two theories, these two formulations. So let us look, both the canonical and the spin form formulation do want to get the physical inner product. They want to get this thing, and the path and the spin form formulation has a certain ansatz for this. And here's a derivation which comes from the canonical theory and which involves this integral. So the physical inner product So this will be the answer for the, from the canonical theory. The physical inner product, which is given by this formula, dt by 2 pi psi e to the itm psi prime, is the time integral of the transition amplitude psi e to the itm psi prime. So this looks like the precisely the thing that in any quantum field theory you would like to compute. Transition amplitudes in order to get your scattering theory, right? So this is the starting point in any textbook on quantum field theory. This is the starting point that you have. You have some Hamiltonian. You want to compute scattering amplitudes of particles. And this is the thing you start with. And then you turn the crank, and after some more or less formal steps, you end up with a path integral. The only difference is that now our M is not a Hamiltonian. It's like something like a Hamiltonian constraint or the master constraint. And you have this T integral here. And this is precisely the reason why it's not a transition amplitude. It's a projection on the physical Hilbert space. So what should we expect if we wanted to give or guess what this is when you really could compute it? So heuristically, I would think that this gives something like psi e to the itm psi prime is equal to some path integral over connections and the electric fields times the action. Well, the action with respect to this formal Hamiltonian M. So that I would guess that this is something like I times time integral dt, space integral d3x. Well, I should write this into the next line. Times exponential I 0 to t dt prime d3x sigma aaj dot eaj minus m of e and a. So this is my heuristic expectation that you should get this when you try to compute the path integral formulation of this transition amplitude. And this, I think this is more or less guaranteed that you will get something like this. You can look this up, for example, in this nice book by, I mean, not this formula, but the formalism to get this in this nice book by Hanno and Teitelbaum. I think it's called Quantization of Constraint Systems. Now this path integral doesn't look at all like the starting point of spin forms model, where you start actually with the Palatini action. So you have here a linear combination of constraints, but not the master constraint. So what do I make out of this, or what's the underlying reason for this? Well, the starting point of spin form models was actually was a seminal work by Carlo and Michael Reisenberger. I will finish in 5 minutes. Yes, I think it's in 5 minutes. And Carlo. And they, I think also Laurent was talking about this. So here they were thinking in terms of the Hamiltonian constraint, and the projection operator corresponding to the Hamiltonian constraint. There's not only one of them, there are infinitely many, so you want to have something like this, product over all points in sigma, delta function of C of x, or so this is formally given by something like a path integral over all possible lapses, e to the I C operator n, where C of n is d3x n C of x. And if you use this projection, then you actually get something like the Palatini action. I want to say that the reason why I think this is problematic is the same reason why somehow one cannot close the algebra associated to the Hamiltonian constraint. The thing is that namely that C of x and C of y, they don't commute with each other. Even worse, C of x is not a diffeomorphism invariant operator. So what the idea, of course, behind this formula is that you want something like an identity like this, C of x product of y over sigma delta of C hat of y. This should be identical to zero. But of course, when these two operators don't commute with each other, then there may be a problem. And problems of this kind have led to the reformulation of everything in terms of the master constraint. So I have talked to some of you in the last couple of days, and my feeling is that some of you think that I don't like spin forms. That's not at all the case. It's just if you push things to the logical frontier and you come from the canonical side and you want things to make work, then you end up with something like the master constraint, or you have to do something completely different. And for me, this is a puzzle, how to make this somehow match with the spin form formulation. And I think we really need to understand how this works. So I think this is a very good point to stop. Thank you.